So welcome. So I heard an interview with an author. The interviewer asked the author, if how literature changes people. And the writer said, I don't think people change very much, but to the extent that people change at all, it's because of some encounter that has love in it. To the extent we change, it's because of some encounter that has love in it. It's hard to change. It's hard to grow. Habits run deep. It's hard to change. And if we're gonna do it, love will be involved. And the kind of cruel irony is that the people we most want to change are the ones we tend to hate the most. And yet, hatred is the single worst way to get someone to change. Right? This is William James. The potentialities of development in human souls are unfathomable. The saints, with their extravagance of human tenderness, are the torchbearers of this belief in the sacredness of everyone. The tip of the wedge, the clearers of desolation, like the single drops which sparkle in the sun, as they're flung far ahead of the advancing edge of a wave. They show the way and are forerunners. The world is not yet with them, so they often seem, in the midst of the world's affairs, to be preposterous. Yet they are animators of potentialities of goodness, which but for them would lie dormant. It's not possible to be quite as mean as we naturally are when they've passed before us. One fire kindles another, and without that overtrust in human worth which they show, the rest of us would lie in spiritual stagnancy. So I'm talking about love, yeah, wisdom and love. There's a character in Dostoevsky said something, the translation's usually, if God doesn't exist, everything is permitted. And I get that fear, but to my mind, it's almost the reverse, Dostoevsky. Meaning, if this life is all we have, if we are living the blink between the two halves of all the time there is, love makes even more sense, becomes even more urgent, more vital. And our afterlife, our legacy, all the time after we die, that will be largely defined by the traces of love that we leave behind. I was as a kid slash as an adult, an aversive type, and first day of middle school, I offered, you know, I think parents asked, like, how was the day? And I offered my own kind of embittered Yelp review before Yelp existed. And this, been reminded of this again by my dad, who said that when asked how was school, my response was, it was like lying on a bed of nails. That was my review. And I was a kind of perceptive kid with zero equanimity, like zero. And especially sensitive to alienation, especially sensitive to the absence, really, of love, whether that's in relationships or school or communities. Just the lack of warmth was very unsettling to me. And I still feel a certain kind of uneasiness, sometimes quite acutely, when there isn't an ambiance of care. Yeah, when that's not the kind of, when love is not forward. Yeah. It's just painful. And I think about that Hafez poem, something like, everyone you meet, your eyes say to them, I love me, right? Something like this. And to pretend otherwise, to pretend that we're not in this reciprocal giving, you know, receiving, this kind of exchange of care, that's painful still. And so as a kid, amidst the kind of intensity of the world and sense of, like, well, we're not just not talking about it, I grew kind of cynical and wasn't so sure about this kind of longing around love. And it's easier and safer to just be dismissive about it. And I remember my first real kind of encounter with Sangha. I was at the time working in residential treatment for adolescent boys, and who was enough psychiatric struggle that needed to be living in a you know, in residential treatment. And I loved those kids and I loved that work, and it was intense on my body and mind. And I remember after a long day of kind of like, or of giving energy, I kind of unconsciously very much like bounded into the apartment where I was living, where my two roommates said they were having a housewarming party, but it was like a meditation. Yeah. And so I kind of like rush in, you know, sort of frenzied, you know, and they're sitting around a table, candle lit, and just finished practicing. And it was a group that came out of a Thich Nhat Hanh young adult retreat. And I just kind of sat down. This is new. And I came into the Dharma, and I almost couldn't believe the kind of the love that I witnessed and in my own teachers. It still touches me deeply. And it was like I had this dim sense, like, oh yeah, somewhere there's got to be some love, deep love, love animated by wisdom. But I hadn't really seen it, even though I had experienced a lot of forms of other kindness and care. And was not, you know, a reverential person by temperament, but it was like, okay, I'll get down on my knees and bow to this. Yeah. And that gesture, that bow, is not elevating some other person above oneself. It's not the realm of comparison at all. It's in the bow, in the reverence, in the devotion, we partake of the goodness. The love that I saw in practice, in practitioners and teachers, was it was a love that was honest, a love that was fully informed by dukkha, by the intensity, the suffering of life. It was a love that was fully compatible with dukkha, which was the only kind of love I could believe in. There's a beautiful Iranian film in the 90s called Taste of Cherry, starring an actor, I think the name is Homayoun Arshadi. And it's a beautiful film, and the writer, Nicole Krauss, wrote a short story about the film called Seeing Arshadi. This character in the film who's looking for a way to die, a very, very compelling, you know, just a beautiful performance and very striking face. And the narrator in Krauss's short story is kind of obsessed with this this character, this actor, Arshadi. And she at some point believes she's seen Arshadi in an ancient Zen garden in Kyoto. She writes, what I knew of love had always stemmed from desire, from the wish to be altered or thrown off course by some uncontrollable force. But in my love for Arshadi, I nearly didn't exist beyond that great feeling. To call it compassion makes it sound like a form of divine love, and it wasn't that. It was terribly human. If anything, it was an animal love, the love of an animal that has been living in an incomprehensible world until one day it encounters another of its kind and realizes that it has been applying its comprehension in the wrong place all along. That think that's what Dharma love feels like. Sense of recognition, sense of remembrance, very embodied aliveness. This love takes many, many forms: generosity and gratitude and compassion and ecstasy, delight, joy, tenderness, devotion, kindness itself, the softening of the heart. Nisargadatta said, in love, there are no strangers. Sharon Salzberg, about 15 years into practice, I believe, she said she did 4 years of intensive metta practice, intensive loving kindness practice. And that was on retreats, long retreat in her daily life. It was metta all the time. And she said that some people were dismissive of that, to do the loving kindness practice, that said, like, well, maybe it's just a good feeling, or it's avoiding suffering, or it's a quote relative practice, it's not a wisdom practice. And in some ways she said, yeah, it's generally not a wisdom practice, but it's so helpful, she said. This whole side of love, the two wings of awakening. Some of us are drawn to the wisdom side, to kind of piercing clarity and cool equanimity, the stillness, the silence. And others are drawn to the the heart side, the love, the warmth, the juiciness of the path. And there's a question that occurs to me, which is like, should we deepen our strengths or should we compensate for our deficits? Yeah. Should we go our natural inclination? Or should we double back and go, you know, we're drawn to love. Okay, do we go to back, you know, double down on the love or go back to wisdom? And I don't know. I'm just making this up. But my sense is, first, we deepen. We actually capitalize on our natural inclination. And then we round out our capacities. We double back to what doesn't feel like the native territory of our own heart mind. And so we do this because unbalanced spiritual power is bad often. Yeah. When one wing gets so much stronger than the other, maybe something gets off. And so, for example, people who feel entitled by their wisdom, yeah, feel like their wisdom entitles them to ignore ordinary love. This is not good. So we deepen the natural inclination of the citta, and then we have to double back and balance these wings. Now, how we express love, that's going to be different for different people. There are temperamental differences. You know, some people feel like they just don't feel kindness or love or something as this like juicy, intense emotional state or something. And And that's totally fine. I think love looks very different in different people, takes on different forms, sometimes juicy, sometimes very quiet. I always remember one monk's love being described as being like light from distant stars. Like light from distant stars. There are deep connections between wisdom and love. We talk about them separately, but deep connections. Love is always attuned, you know. Like if empathy isn't accurate, it's not really empathy. Yeah, it's attuned. This love is attuned. We're not misconstruing the other. Yeah, that takes some wisdom to see clearly. It's so painful to be misconstrued. And so our wisdom helps us see the inner life of others more clearly, not to misconstrue them. And it's worth kind of inquiring, like, yeah, how attuned, how profoundly attuned, how subtle can our empathy and care become? I don't think that ever ends, you know? It's like, how nuanced can our view of the inner life of another become? How exquisite can it become? And Thich Nhat Hanh says, if you pour a handful of salt into a cup of water, the water becomes undrinkable. But if you pour the salt into a river, people can continue to draw water to cook, wash, and drink. The river is immense, and it has the capacity to receive, embrace, transform. When our hearts are small, our understanding and compassion are limited, and we suffer, we can't accept or tolerate others, their shortcomings. We demand they change. But when our hearts expand, these same things don't make us suffer anymore. We have a lot of understanding, compassion, and can embrace others. We accept others as they are, and then they have a chance to transform. Understanding someone's suffering is the best gift you can give another person. Understanding is love's other name. If you don't understand, you can't love. Understanding is love's other name. That's very beautiful. To see more deeply, more clearly, to have a more refined view of the heart of another, this enables a deeper kind of love. Love is necessary in the development of wisdom. At various points, love is necessary. Loving awareness, that phrase, is used, I think, in part because it's really hard to open to phenomena without care. You know, like to say, to open to your life, open to your thought, your feeling. Without love, that's rough. That's rough. To open to dukkha. The truth of dukkha that we suffer, that all beings suffer, that truth needs to be grieved for a long, long time. That takes love. This is the path of purification. We resist dukkha so deeply. Our practice is to do the opposite, to approach rather than contain. To approach dukkha, to comprehend it. And the fullest form of approach is a kind of love. The knot of self, this is one of the cardinal understandings on the path. And the knot of self is like a kind of wound, you know, like all the places we congeal, all the places, the little whirlpools of energy where the self congeals, these places of contraction, this moralism and self-rigid self-definition, all of this, all that needs love. It needs love. Yeah. We fall in love with the path itself, you know? And it's a little bit like parallels the way one might fall in love with a person. Yeah. First person I fell in love with as a kid, you know, I was too embarrassed to say I love you. I just, with my finger on their skin, traced out the words. I think I fell in love with the path in a similar kind of shy, halting way, now deep. And And so we consider, what's our relationship to the path? Where is the love with respect to the path? We depend on the love of Sangha, teachers, to be a kind of mirror and solitary practice. Secluded practice is beautiful, but we also need our neurosis to kind of like bump into things. And sometimes practicing on our own, it doesn't bump into enough. So we have the gift of others. Yeah, it's not their only gift, but that's part of it. And the love from others helps us see ourselves more clearly, our foibles, our goodness. I don't know. I think a lot of people really just begin to learn about their lovability only through the gaze of the other. Yeah, they start to entertain, you know, in that gaze, the care of a Sangha. Well, maybe the goodness they're perceiving is not a dream. And we start to feel that in our own heart. Sometimes the goodness of others like acts as a mirror in which we see our own defilements, you know. It's like the kind of screen of the other's goodness, like our defilements cast a kind of shadow, and it's on that, against that screen, that we see our own roughness or our own whatever. And as we develop insight, as we develop wisdom, some points we're like deeply dependent on the care of the Sangha, of a teacher. You know, there are times in practice where we are quite defenseless, and mind states that are very foreign and very disoriented and very slippery and very, feels like we're living on a razor's edge between heaven and hell. There can be disorientation and just a lack of signpost, fear, intense fear. And we need the confidence, the love of a teacher to say, keep going. This is Dharma pain. Keep going. And so there's really love in the beginning, middle, and end. Love, quiet form, the big, loud form. This is how our practice manifests in the world too. And sometimes it's very subtle, you know. It's like one of my teachers, Shinzen Young, says that the way you transmit the Dharma, the way we do it, is kind of through our pores. That's how we share our practice. So no matter what we do in our life, how we spend our time, a lot of the trace of our life is how we impact the networks of people with which we engage, the kind of kindness and respect and the care, the ways where our life is a kind of quiet blessing of some sort. We are not a cause for more dukkha, for fear. Yeah? And that kind of ripples out. And that doesn't mean we're talking about practice or talking about love or talking about anything. It's just our own heart has a kind of effect. And sometimes the love we offer is not subtle. It's, we actually have to step up more directly, more boldly. We're at, I feel, a very interesting moment in the kind of dialogue between this ancient Asian monastic tradition and at least this culture, I was reading the suttas recently, and there was a way, in a new sense, I got a feel for the Buddha just gazing out upon the world and it breaking his heart. And there's a sense of like, let me out. Almost like the depth of care, caring so much, and yet seeing the endlessness of samsara. And it was just like, too much. And so the Buddha turned to what he could manage. turn to freeing his own heart. And since it began, this path has been a Nibbana-centric teaching, a liberatory path, a path that seeks to uproot greed and delusion in our own heart. And the Buddha, in my reading, understanding, wished well, radically wished well upon the world, but was not driven to redeem samsara. Really wanted out. And left this incredibly beautiful technology. And in this narrow approach that I'm articulating, which is just one aspect of it, in this narrow approach, the practice is for me to effectively treat all of my suffering as if it's my problem, my responsibility. To inquire, how am I participating in the cycles of dukkha? Now, we might know that causality is more complex. The reasons for my suffering may be many. But for the purposes of my own training, for the purposes of diminishing greed and delusion in me, I kind of practice as if it's all my fault. I take full responsibility. Everything that feels imperfect, I own as a kind of way that I'm participating in the cycles of dukkha, of proliferating, fabricating suffering. And in this vision of practice, the path of liberation is to become disenchanted from the world, to give up on samsara, to not stop letting go, to claim territory is to become territorial, is to suffer. And when I consider the world, the Buddha inhabited, the rampant disease and violence and famine, the unreliability of food production, just staggering kind of maternal infant mortality, so much unexplained, just that endlessness of samsara. And there's much that is dramatically better now. Dramatically. The global burden of disease, reductions in violence, the numbers of people living in extreme poverty, scientific opportunities just create there are many opportunities for the reduction of suffering. That's all true. That's all real. And yet, if you look at this country where I am, or this world, so much of it still runs on greed, hate, and delusion. And because the tools at our disposal are so powerful, that is now literally a threat to our existence. So from the book, The Precipice, the threats to humanity and how we address them define our time. The advent of nuclear weapons posed a real risk of human extinction in the 20th century. With the continued acceleration of technology and without serious efforts to protect humanity, there's strong reason to believe the risk will be higher this century and increasing with each century that technological progress continues. because these human-generated risks outstrip all natural risks combined, they set the clock on how long humanity has left to pull back from the brink. I'm not claiming that extinction is the inevitable conclusion of scientific progress or even the most likely outcome. What I am claiming is that there has been a robust trend towards increases in the power of humanity, which has reached a point where we pose a serious risk to our own existence. So what is a practitioner to do? What is a lover of Dhamma to do? Well, it's my view. One of the effects of this dilemma is that I think we're becoming ambivalent about a Nibbana-centric life, a life devoted to this radical freedom. And for sure, there are moments where it can feel like truly decadent to be fiddling with the subtle kalesas as climate change bears down, other threats to human welfare bear down. And one of the things that can happen in our heart mind is that we then try to make the Dharma do double duty, yeah, to uproot greed, hate, and delusion in our own heart, to free ourselves and to free the world. And the risk is that practice becomes a certain kind of multitasking, and we become split. And I'm wrestling in my own heart how to meet this. And my answers are evolving. Questions are evolving. But for me, Dharma is it's a most beautiful medicine, and maybe the only medicine for certain forms of disease. But it's not the medicine for all forms of disease. In other words, dukkha is an interdisciplinary problem. And so maybe our practice can be liberation-centric, Nibbana-centric, can be single-pointed. But our debt to others doesn't end there. The obligations of our love do not end there. We cultivate wisdom and freedom and love. But then, how will we spend it? How will we spend it? Over time, we actually generate a kind of surplus of happiness. Yeah. How will we spend it? This is, you know, after all, it's a renunciate path. Yeah. And so I'm inquiring in my own heart, how do we join into the streams of love that are already flowing, that others are already leading? How do we bring our Dharma heart into this kind of interdisciplinary realm of trying to meet suffering in all the levels at which it constellates. And so I get simple in my practice. But then I live with the question, how will we spend our love? Let's just sit for a minute.